Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals, the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you. Y'all can be seated. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Good morning. Justices Kelly, Triana, and myself are thrilled to have you today. I'll call the case to order. This is cause number 0323635 CV Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance versus Harper. And as you know, counsel, this case is being broadcast via YouTube live, and then it'll also just simply be on our library of YouTube. So all the people that aren't here that I know are waiting to hear what you have to say this morning will be watching you on YouTube today. With that said, as you know, each side has 20 minutes, and typically we open with 15 minutes, and then the other side goes with 20, and then the remainder of 5. If that's not what you want, please let me know as you announce ready today. With that said, let me hear announcements of ready from the appellant.
Thank 15 minutes. Five reserve for
is fine. Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Dallas. And then let me hear announcements of ready from the appellee.
Blaine McSwain with Beard Colchin on behalf of appellee Harper Crystal. I also have Andy McSwain here with me. And if it's possible, a 2-minute reminder warning for my time would be lovely.
Okay. And I believe the lights will do that with the yellow, so you will actually get that 2-minute warning. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And with that said, let me turn the floor over to Ms. Dallas. Let's proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Ms. Harper's lawsuit and this appeal arise from a claim for underinsured motorist benefits available through auto policy issued by Allstate. Allstate raised 6 issues in its brief, and those issues really fit into kind of 2 buckets, a rendition points bucket and a remand points bucket. There are 2 reasons, primarily, why the court should vacate the attorney's fees award and render judgment on the jury verdict, which was a verdict for Ms. Harper, but only on the jury's findings for damages and not attorney's fees. So first, the request and award for attorney's fees came post-verdict and was without adequate pleadings to support it and without proper findings from the jury on reasonableness and necessity, which were required under Rule 279 and Rule 301 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. So specifically with that, under Rule 279, Ms. Harper.
And counsel, before
sure.
You get into that about the adequacy of the pleadings, I'd like for you to address the issue of notice pleadings in Rule 47 on how Ms. Harper's pleadings, although simply in 6.4, making a statement of law, that under Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code that they can get fees, how that did not put Allstate on notice under Rule 47 therein invoking special exceptions requirements of 90 and 91 under the rules. Have you got anything that can address notice pleadings and the special exceptions issue?
Yes, Your Honor. So the Texas Supreme Court in the Bockett versus Herring decision speaks to the issue of the jury being the party to determine reasonableness and notice, and then the reasonableness of the fees. And then in the Wells Fargo Bank versus Murphy decision, the Supreme Court, which is cited in our brief, but is 458 Southwest 3rd, 912, they make clear that the party requesting fees must affirmatively plead for them to be eligible. And then they turn and look to the pleadings in that case, and they say, well, they both stated that they were entitled to recover fees, and they asked for the recovery of attorney's fees in their prayer. So the distinction here is a statement that fees are available under the Declaratory Judgment Act, which nobody's disputing. But to invoke that right to obtain the fees, there has to be a prayer for relief that covers the fees, and then, Your Honor, also an affirmative claim that the party is seeking fees under the Declaratory Judgment Act.
And so your position is that her pleading that says such other and further relief, general and special, legal and equitable, to which the plaintiffs are entitled, is not enough, because I do know in her pleadings it is devoid of any statement that says, like everywhere else in her petition, plaintiff seeks, plaintiff request, plaintiff seeks cost. And I do note that nowhere does she say plaintiff seeks attorney's fees.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is our position. And I do think that this court's, although a slightly different context because it had to do with restrictive covenants, the Real Text Houston Management case from this court, which is a 2023 Westlaw 8655279 case, does speak to there needing to be some level of specificity in the request for fees. So I think a boilerplate statement of law that fees are available without a follow-up request doesn't put us on notice. But I think let's not give short shrift to the issue under Rule 79, which is that, okay, let's assume, and we don't agree, but let's assume for the purposes of today that there was some kind of claim made, that we were on notice that special exceptions rules did apply. Of course, we don't agree, but not conceding that. But under Rule 279, the issue of whether what the reasonable necessary fees were is a fact issue that goes to the jury. So that goes back to that Bockett versus Herring case that I mentioned at the start, that says that under the Declaratory Judgment Act, the reasonableness and necessity is a fact issue for the fact finder. And in this case, there was a request, a demand for a jury trial, and also the payment of the jury fee by Allstate. And so Allstate, we believe, was entitled to have the jury determine that. Now,
I guess your client's position is, if we do find that there's not a pleading issue, that you did have sufficient notice because of the pleadings, then you're asking us to remand for their attorney's fees to be determined by a jury?
No, Your Honor, we think there was a waiver of the issue under Rule 279. So because Rule 279 requires fact issues to be submitted in the jury charge, and specifically states that the failure of a plaintiff to request and get necessary findings in a jury charge is a waiver, we believe that issue under Rule 279 actually fits into that rendition bucket that I talked about before. That issue is really very straightforward. You know, I think all of us are familiar with the idea that, you know, you're not going to get relief that you don't ask for, and you're not entitled to relief if you fail to submit an element of your claim or an aspect of what you're seeking. And that's really plain and simple what happened here. You know, I think the context of the Bockett versus Herring case is really useful. And then we also cited to, I'm sorry, the season of my allergies are hurting me, but and we also cited
friends
we cited to a few other cases in our brief, the University of Texas at Austin versus Abilese case from 1996 from this court, THPD Inc. versus I think Continental Imports Inc. My short side is a little confusing there, but I think it's Continental. That was this court in 2008, and you know, and then there is a really directly on point Eastland Court of Appeals case that says that a party waives its right to recover attorney's fees when it fails to put on evidence of the attorney's fees and fails to request that the trial court submit a question on attorney's fees to the jury. So I think that those cases are really all directly on point under this Rule 279 issue, and that failure to submit it is an easy rendition point. The other rendition point here. Well, I want to take a moment to distinguish a couple of the cases, going back to that 301 issue that the plaintiff and appellees have cited. And those are Good, V. Baker, Swate, and the Nisby case. And I think one of the key elements in each of those cases were pleadings that were slightly more robust than we have here, and disclosures. So what we have here is no prayer for relief that includes a request for fees, and then never throughout the course of litigation, which was pending for a number of years due to COVID, never a disclosure of an expert on attorney's fees, never a disclosure in the amounts and methods of damages section, never a disclosure of the amounts of fees that were being sought or the method of calculating them. And then we actually ended up having, in our brief, I'll get the pin site on this, but our brief addresses a few specific requests that were made for documents evidencing time, and then documents relied on by fact witnesses and experts. Those are at 289 and 290 of the clerk's record, where Allstate just objected and never responded. So we think under Rule 193.6, there are some significant disclosure issues that really should have prevented that issue from going to the jury. So,
and what was the objection?
There was an objection made first under Rule 279. There was an objection made under Rule 193.6, and then there was also an objection made that the attorney wasn't sworn in and wasn't presenting evidence under oath in a proper form for the court to consider.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant, what were the objections to the, you said for the disclosures, there were, you requested for timesheets and there was an objection and then it just went
sure,
away.
Boilerplate privilege boilerplate privilege objections and irrelevant objections as well, which would certainly tend to suggest that they didn't think that they were pursuing those fees. Okay, so turning to the kind of second, sort of a two, if 301 and 279 are point A and B on the rendition points, point C would be an insufficient evidence to support the fees. So again, whether the court should have awarded them or not, Allstate has argued that there was insufficient evidence under Rormos to support it, to support the award, and so that would also be a rendition point. And sort of more specifically, getting into the nitty gritty of that, there was a motion for fees presented and an affidavit from trial counsel that was incredibly conclusory. I'm experienced, I know the reasonable rates, I'm a licensed attorney, and I will point out that he was licensed during the course of the litigation and had only been licensed a couple years by the time he gave that testimony, such that he was testifying about reasonable rates for lawyers with multiple times his experience level, and providing very conclusory sentences on being able to judge the reasonableness of their rates as well as those of the paralegals and support staff. And then what we have in the record was about a five-page breakdown of certain tasks that with some time indications in terms of maybe how long was spent, but one of the issues that is really lacking is who did it. There is a reference to paralegals, but there's no information about their level of experience. And so there's a lot of elements of that affidavit and then the, supporting documentation as it is that really ultimately don't provide the level of evidence required under Rormos.
But for the attorneys, their names are listed on that sheet, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. But again, I think the issue with even that, although they are identified, is that Mr. Karimi, who was the expert offered by Harper, really probably did not demonstrate his appropriate qualifications to render the opinions, and the opinions themselves were quite conclusory.
And counsel, I'm assuming that Ms. Harper will be hard-pressed to argue that this post-verdict has any relationship to some kind of trial amendment effort. Was there any kind of motion for leave to bring this issue before the trial court? And could you arguably say, even past verdict, you're still in trial somehow, and therefore this was some kind of, you know, Rule 63 trial amendment?
That is an argument that was brought up in their brief for the first time. So when in the trial court, there was no motion for leave to file a trial amendment. The there was no stipulation prior to impaneling the jury or prior to the jury being charged with the case about submitting fees to the court. Of course, that is a thing that happens. As a practical matter, practitioners can and do that. That did not happen in this case, and I think a number of the cases that counsel is going to point to are cases where that is a large distinguishing factor. And so, you know, no, I don't think we have a proper trial amendment when we've closed evidence, we have a verdict. There's been no stipulation about taking up fees after the fact, and the Texas Supreme Court has made clear that the issue of reasonableness and necessity is a fact issue for the jury. In my 30 seconds left,
yes,
unless the court has questions, I do want to briefly touch on our remand point. To be clear, Allstate's preferred outcome here is a rendition of judgment vacating the fee award, and we think we've supported that. But I do not want to give short shrift to our right to a jury trial on the issue of fees. And we've cited the court to a case out of the Houston Court of Appeals called OGU versus CIA Services, where the court very squarely, there's no other issues they can address, and they very squarely address this issue of the right to jury trial on the fees. And so for these reasons, we would ask that the court vacate the judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. And Ms. McSwain. Yes, ma'am. Morning.
May it please the court. My name is Blaine McSwain, and I represent the appellee, Crystal Harper. Before I get started, as you've heard, this is an uninsured, underinsured motorist case. And I think the points here are very important to, across the board, the rights that insureds have to seek fees from their insurance company in a variety of different ways, and the grant that the Uniform Declaratory Judgment has to allow that.
And counsel,
yes.
Is there any case that's on point that indicates that you're pleading finally, Section 37.009 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code provides that the court may award cost and reasonable and necessary attorney's fees as equitable and just, constitutes an actual request. And as I noted before, you request a lot of things in your petition. You never request specifically fees. You ask for plaintiff seeks a declaration. Plaintiff seeks a declaration. Plaintiff specifically requests to collect. Plaintiff seeks recovery of cost. It's devoid of plaintiff seeks attorney's fees.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. I would say that, as was brought up in as you posed the question, does that give fair notice under Rule 47? I think that as a start,
Do you have a case on that?
Rule 47, and I think also the Wells Fargo case speaks to that. In that case, and that was mentioned in appellate's brief, the court actually found that just saying that you can recover, and they did have the addition in that case of a request for fees in their damages section, but I think it's telling that in that case they found, you know, that's proper, that brings it forward. I think the fair notice standard is pretty well established that the I do have a case. The Texarkana Court of Appeals, they defined the fair notice standard as requires opposing attorney of reasonable competence can ascertain the nature and basic issues of the controversy. I think that statement that they can recover fees under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act From that, an attorney can ascertain the basic nature of the controversy. But additionally, the cases Good v. Baker, SWAT v. Medina, and NISBE v. Dentsply International, Inc. all kind of address that even if the pleadings aren't proper, and actually in Good v. Baker, that party never mentioned attorney fees in their pleadings at all. There was not a single mention of it. And
but did they also not disclose in their request for disclosures any expert or requests for attorney's fees in their disclosures?
I believe they did not. I would have to go back and check, but I believe they did not. In that case, it was that court looked at that request post-verdict, post-bench trial, and they decided that even though it wasn't in the pleadings, this request post-bench trial was enough to support that. And they looked back at the San Antonio Court of Appeals in the SWAT case, and in that case, the San Antonio Court of Appeals said explicitly, post-verdict motions for attorney's fees that effectively serve as trial amendments may be granted within the trial court's discretion. And in this case, the trial court did grant it within her discretion. You don't have to
Ms. McSwain, let me interrupt you.
Yes.
Is there a case, though, like you said, that was a bench trial? Have you found, because I don't think that I've found a case that is directly on point that allows for a post-jury trial verdict that allows or has said it's okay for the court to award attorney's fees other than when they have stipulated. Mm-hmm. I know we have the case where both parties stipulated that they were going to argue attorney's fees to the court. Is there any case that you can point us to that has allowed when there's been a jury demand for the court to take attorney's fees away from the jury and decide those?
Your Honor, I don't think there's a case on point about that. And I think that's because the issue of whether or not you have a right to a jury trial for attorney's fees specifically under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act has not been fully established. So I think that's why there's not a case on that, which was a huge point in our argument. The arguments that appellant has raised about Rule 279 and all those issues, the waiver of the jury trial issue, none of those come into play if you don't have a right to a jury trial under the Declaratory Judgment Act for attorney's fees. And to determine that, the courts look to the plain language of the statute. In this case, the statute says that in any proceeding under this chapter, the court may award reasonable costs and necessary attorney's fees as are equitable and just. And there's that Houston Court of Appeals case that took a look at that and said you're entitled to a jury trial. But I think looking at the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act as a whole, that's not necessarily the case. Can you try attorney's fees to a jury under this act? Yes, I think you can. But I don't think you have to, because the trial court is granted such a wide grant of discretion.
Well, let's assume that for a moment. Then if we agree that it could be taken from the jury and tried in front of the court itself, how do you get past, where in the record is evidence of lack of surprise and the requirement to have good cause in order to even bring the information under the rules of discovery when you've never disclosed it in your request for disclosures? Isn't this trial by ambush?
Your Honor, I understand that argument. That would be under the Rule 193.6. And under that, you either can show good cause or lack of unfair surprise or unfair prejudice. And I think here the record shows a lack of unfair surprise. And that's a combination of things. The fact that it was mentioned in the pleadings from the onset of the case. They actually asked a question about it in discovery. They did not seek to compel any of that. And then actually this motion, the time that the motion set on file, I think also shows that there's a lack of unfair surprise. And the standard is unfair, not just surprise, unfair surprise. And a case that's kind of telling on that, I think, is the Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company v. Hal Herring, which is a Fort Worth Court of Appeals case that was cited in our brief. And in that case, the court, and there was slightly different circumstances, but in that case, the court found that because of the length that the motion was on file and the fact that the request for attorney's fees was mentioned in the pleadings, there was no unfair surprise to Allstate in that case. And I think that we've got a similar circumstance here.
And that was a post-jury trial verdict motion in that case?
Yes, and I actually believe that one was, there were circumstances where it ended up being kind of agreed to have it told later, just to be candid in that case.
Okay, but they agreed to have it heard before a judge later?
There was a request in trial to have a bifurcated trial on fees, and then there was an objection to not timely designating and not providing any materials, and so they decided to take that issue up later. And when they took that issue up later in a hearing, the court, when they reviewed it, found that there was evidence in the record of a lack of unfair surprise. And as long as there's evidence in the record of a lack of unfair surprise, then the standard is abuse of discretion. And it's,
but there was no motion to bifurcate here. You agree, right?
Correct. Yes, there was no motion to bifurcate here. But I think that goes back to the reason that's proper is because of the language of the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act.
One of the reasons you said there wasn't, you didn't believe there was unfair surprise is because there was a discovery request, you objected, and they didn't file a motion to compel. But wouldn't your client's discovery responses of relevance, how would that put them on notice that the fees would become an issue later?
Yes, I think the 193.6, it's within the trial court's discretion to allow information that has not been timely supplemented or timely provided in discovery, in allow that information to be either in trial or in a motion. And in this case—
Doesn't it require good cause for your failure to supplement?
No, Your Honor, it's good cause or a showing of the rule change. I think it was about 2015. It used to be that you had to show good cause, and now it's either good cause or a lack of unfair surprise. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the issue here. This trial court in this case decided that there was not a lack of unfair surprise in this matter and allowed that motion to go forward. And I think there's also a significant waiver issue in the objection under Rule 193.6, that falls under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1. You have to make a timely objection and obtain a ruling on that. And in the Trevino versus City of Pearland case, I believe that's also the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, addressed that specifically in a pretty similar circumstance, and they found in where a party did not designate a expert on attorney's fees and didn't produce any records, when the party failed to object and get a ruling on that objection, it was actually waived on appeal, and they did not preserve error on that. I think there's an issue here on that too, and as long as there is some showing of lack of unfair surprise in the record, which I think there is indicated in the hearing transcript and what was talked about in the hearing and the fact of the motion being on file for such a significant amount of time before the file hearing, it was about 7 months. That means that they've waived that argument here on appeal. The judge allowed it in, and it's an abuse of discretion standard. And within her discretion, she decided, after hearing all of the facts and circumstances of the case, that she was going to allow the evidence of attorney's fees to be heard and did hear that evidence.
Okay. And do you consider that the constituting leave of court, even though you don't use the words seeking leave of court, to pretty much seek some kind of trial amendment?
I think essentially that would be a good qualifier.
So we're
for
supposed
it.
To just infer?
Well, I think because they failed to obtain a ruling on their objection, you don't even have to infer. They can't raise it on appeal if they didn't make a timely objection and get a ruling under Rule 33.1.
Let's shift ahead to sufficiency. You know, we're going past all these other arguments. And let's assume even the affidavit has been entered and all of that is in evidence. How does that meet the Rormo standard for sufficiency?
I would say that the affidavit was pretty, it laid out his experience and why he was qualified as an expert, and that he had reviewed the records that were attached. It had a business records affidavit to prove those up. And I think it was pretty detailed in the instance of, this is how I'm qualified, and here is what we did, see the records that are attached to this, and it gave that information, and then additionally gave further information in the hearing to the judge.
Your Ms. Dallas was saying that there wasn't information in the record about some of the other parties, so did that affidavit address Ms., I think it's Venezuela's background and experience? Because she's also listed on that billing statement.
Yes, he addressed it as, I've reviewed this, all of the people who worked on this are experienced, and it was a broad statement, but with no ruling on whether or not that was insufficient evidence at the time. I mean, they objected, but again, another issue where they didn't get a ruling on this.
But doesn't legal sufficiency survive? I mean, whether it's sufficient evidence, regardless of their objection, if it's insufficient, it's insufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, but the standard there is on legal sufficiency. They have to show that there's no evidence in the record to support the finding, and here there is evidence.
What evidence in the record is there? I think the paralegal billed like $27,000, and that paralegal is unnamed, if I'm correct. I may forget the record. So how could that possibly be sufficient if we don't even know who the human is that provided $27,000 worth of services?
Yeah, I think the statement in the affidavit that he had reviewed everything that had been done, everything in the records, and that the people who did the work were qualified in their experience. And
is that not conclusory evidence, which therefore is no evidence?
Your Honor, I would say that in the matter of attorney's fees, we're all attorneys here, and the judge was an attorney. Everybody sitting at that table was an attorney, and the judge has wide discretion on whether to grant fees that are equitable and just, and if she thought it was conclusory at the time, then she could have decided that then. I think on appeal here, to find that she abused her discretion because that statement was a bit broad is not in conformance with what the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, its purpose, and that wide grant of discretion that is given to the trial court to determine fees and award them.
Have you read one of our most recent cases on this, Schultz v. Schultz, talking about it, where we most recently overturned a case? Or rather reversed attorney's fees based on sufficiency? Have you?
I do not believe. I read a ton of cases in preparation for this, but I think I missed that one. You said it was Schultz v. Schultz?
Schultz v. Schultz. It came out this summer in July.
I don't believe I've read that one, but I would love the opportunity to read that and provide the way that that could possibly be distinguished, or how we meet that standard laid out in that, if in a few days or whenever I get back to the office and the opportunity. Yeah. Yes. I think the affidavit that is here and the information that was included in it, I think it meets the standards that the Texas Supreme Court set out in the Ramos Ventures standard. The fact of the matter is that attorney's fees are just a little bit different from all the other evidence that really, I think, gets presented in court. Whenever you're reviewing a summary judgment record and you've got lay witnesses, affidavits, all those issues, I think, are looked at differently for good reason. Attorney's fees, because everybody there is an attorney and the judge can look at an attorney's fee and say, I don't think you proved that right, or I don't think there's enough evidence of that there. And when the trial judge has the discretion to decide that, unless there, as this case, this is a sufficient legal sufficiency challenge, unless there's no evidence at all in the record, which I think it's not just the affidavit, it's the affidavit and the billing records and the testimony that Mr. Karami gave in the hearing. I think all that in combination show that there's more than enough evidence to support the finding that the trial court made at the time. And I'd like to briefly address, there was some talk about the post-verdict motions and whether they qualify as trial amendments. Chief Justice, I believe that you posed that question. And I think that's answered, as I've stated, by the SWAT court. And the fact that you can absolutely, other courts of appeals in Texas have found that these post-verdict motions for attorney's fees, even if your pleadings aren't absolutely perfect, which were, I think they still meet the fair notice standards, but if they're not perfect, your post-verdict motion, that qualifies as a pleading that supports your award. And the reasoning in that court's was because it was based on it was a trial amendment. And if the judge in their discretion decides that you've got enough there, they can grant essentially a trial amendment. I think that's what we had here in this circumstance.
So the trial continued post-jury verdict?
The way that the SWAT court interpreted it, yes. The fact...
But that was a directed... That was a bench trial.
That was a bench trial.
Okay.
The rule 301 is that the pleadings have to conform with the judgment. And I think that they do in this case because we've got that fair notice standard met by the mention in the pleadings at the onset of the case. That was long filed, been there for a very long time, plenty of opportunity. If Allstate was unclear if the plaintiff was going to be seeking fees or not, they could have specially accepted. And the law in Texas is if you do not specially accept to a pleading defect, then it's actually waived. And I think in this case there is evidence here that that fair notice standard was met, and because they didn't specially accept, they actually waived their ability to argue that it was not met on appeal. In looking at this, I think the big question that needs to be answered here is the grant of discretion under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, what effect that has, and if the court, which there's case law about the wide discretion that the trial court has to award fees, but if the court has the ability to look at a fee award from a jury and either raise it or lower it or decide on their own to not impanel a jury, which there's a case from the Beaumont Court of Appeals, the River Plantation case, where the trial court refused to even impanel a jury at all on the issue of attorney's fees, and that was upheld by the Beaumont Court of Appeals, and recently the Texas Supreme Court affirmed that decision. Really, the issue here is if the trial court has this wide discretion that the legislature has granted it to change an award, why can't they just award it from the beginning? And I think it conforms with the purpose of the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act for that to be the rule, because the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act is meant to be construed liberally to for the rights of the parties. And the rights of the parties here is that this is an underinsured motorist case. Ms. Harper had to sue her own insurance company for coverage under her policy. And as the court knows, the insurance companies in first-party cases do not have the obligation to tender any payment until judgment is certain. So there's absolutely no incentive to pay in a timely manner because they don't have to, according to the law. And the Texas Supreme Court recently in the Allstate v. Irwin case found that Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, you can get fees. And I think that's fair under the circumstances and the law because of the way that the uninsured motorist coverage works. For the insured to get her full recovery in these matters, the right for attorney's fees should be allowed, even if that's on a post-verdict motion, since the court has such wide discretion under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act. And for those reasons, the things I didn't address today, I would point you to our brief. For those reasons, we'd ask that you affirm the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And now let's hear from the appellant. And I certainly want to hear from the appellant a response to the argument that somehow the language in the UDJA related to attorney's fees does not require a jury to consider the issues.
Your Honor, one thing I did not hear Appellee's address is the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Bockett versus Herring, where the court says that the act, talking about the Declaratory Judgment Act, imposes four limitations on the court's discretion. The first is that the fees must be reasonable. In general, and I'm quoting, in general, the reasonableness of attorney's fees, the recovery of which is authorized by statute, is a question of fact for the jury's determination. And then the court goes on to talk about the fees being necessary. Again, that's a fact issue, reasonableness and necessity. The act's other two limitations are on attorney's fees awards are that they must be equitable and just. Those are matters for the court's discretion. So the court's discretion is limited to what is equitable and just in making that determination, you know, under all of the circumstances in the case and under the law and under the Declaratory Judgment Act. But I do not believe there is discretion to take from the jury the issue of reasonableness and necessity when a jury trial has been demanded by the parties. And when the fee has been paid, I will also mention that because that happened here, because Allstate demanded a jury and paid the fee, and then plaintiff did not submit the question to that jury, the plaintiff waived their right to recover reasonable and necessary fees. I also want to briefly take a moment to talk about the affidavit. Usually when you're an appellant, if you're fighting on legal sufficiency points, you're losing, but I do think it's worth mentioning that at 330 and 331 of the clerk's record, we have the meat and potatoes of Mr. Karimi's affidavit. And I want to point out to the court that he does not discuss the experience, education, or training of either of the lawyers other than himself who appear on it's not an invoice, it's not a typical bill, but the sort of fee statement that was generated to support the fee request. He just simply says that the attorneys in our law firm are qualified by education, training, and experience to perform the services required. There's nothing about why the services were necessary. And that's, I think, a sort of classic conclusory topic sentence that doesn't really get into what the education, training, or experience were, or any of the other things that would be required to support Lodestar under Wormos. So, I feel I did happen to pull the Schultz decision. I think in preparing for the argument, because it's not mentioned in our briefs, I wasn't going to raise it, but I do think that a similar issue is presented here. And in that decision, the court said that the testimony and billing records fail to provide any detail as to the specific tasks performed, who performed them, and the amount of time. We have a little different scenario here, I will acknowledge, based on the record that was submitted, but we still have problems with the specificity of the tasks. There's some descriptions that just say email. Okay, what was it about? Why was it necessary? We can't really tell. And there's quite a few entries along those lines. And then we also have sort of the problem of not identifying certain individuals. So really from Allstate's perspective, this is a case where the plaintiffs should have submitted a jury question on reasonableness and necessity. If that was something that they were truly pursuing, it should have been disclosed in the case much earlier. It was not, and not only did they not disclose that they were seeking the fees, they didn't disclose an expert, they didn't provide discovery, they had an obligation to do that under the rules to properly supplement incomplete discovery, and that wasn't done. And then at the trial, the main fact issue is not submitted to the jury. I think that's a clear waiver under 279, I'm getting my numbers flipped, but our briefing is correct on it. So with that, unless there's further questions, I'll yield my 10 seconds.
Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The case will be submitted, and just for clarity, we know what's in the Schultz opinion, and we do not need any additional briefing. All right. Thank you. Court will stand in recess. Thank you.